You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Halaiva. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm. The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will sink our teeth into a real food factory that lives right in our garden and give you some tips on grooming and tending your plants, including the ins and outs of foliar feeding. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
How is it growing?
Luminously.
It is summertime. Things are bursting out of the soil, and we want to encourage you to burst onto the internet and visit kkcr.org, because while we did really well in our spring fund drive, we need that trickle of support to keep coming in toward our station. There's lots of great resources. You can see the program guide there. There's lots of archived shows, feature stories. In all ways, it's a great place to visit if you love your community radio station, whether you're listening right here on the beautiful Garden Island or across the globe, as we have many listeners who like to check in on Kauai after visiting here maybe 20 years ago, and they just have always kept their love going for this place, or maybe it's a place they visit, family and friends who live here. So anyway, encouraging you, please, to know that your tax-deductible donation can be received at kkcr.org. Consider giving us a little boost today. And we're going to start with our celestial session, looking to the heavenly bodies above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities that we do. And we turn to the traditional wisdom of the Hawaiian people who observed this land for millennia. That means thousands of years. They observed the minute changes and signs that portended certain influences and certain results on the growth of plants, on fishing as well, their success in fishing. So we're going to look at that traditional wisdom that is still applied today and carried on, unbroken, an unbroken chain of observation and action. So much thanks to the 2015 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar for today's reading. Today's Hawaiian moon is Muku. This is in the Emi, or diminishing Anahulu, and in fact it is at the very end of the Hawaiian moon month. Muku rose over Kauai at 7:08 a.m. this morning. She will reach her transit, or highest point in the sky, at 1:52 p.m., and she'll set at 8:35 p.m. this evening. 2% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated, one of those amazing crescents that just takes your breath away. New moon was actually yesterday at 4:05 a.m. Seems as if perhaps the calendar is a bit off here, given the fact that Muku means to vanish. And if the new moon, which was vanished, was yesterday's rising moon, it seems like maybe we're a day off. I'm not really sure. But at any rate, we're going to go with the reading for Muku. It's the 30th night of the moon when it has entirely disappeared, or Muku. So maybe it rises and it's still vanished and starts peeking out in the beginning. But that's generally the sign for Hilo moon, is when you can see it when it's setting in the evening time, just before dark descends. As the moon cycle is 29 and a half days long, some Hawaiian moon calendars have this, Muku, as an intermittent moon to balance the cycle. So depending on which month in the year you're looking at, it will either include Muku or not. The Hanalei moon and tide calendar that we use sometimes places Mauli, the moon that precedes Muku, and Muku on the same day. However, this is just a straight-up Muku day according to the calendar. Planting recommendations on this particular moon: bananas will bear bunches one Muku long, a Muku being a measurement of length from the fingertips of one hand to the elbow of the other arm, when both arms are extended to the side.
That's a big rack of bananas.
It's big. So you better have all of your nutrients in place if you want to grow a Muku of bananas. This day, however, is not recommended for sweet potatoes, traditionally speaking. Trees and sugarcane are said to prosper if planted on this day. And fishing is said to be good on Muku. And there's your Hawaiian moon for the day.
Excellent. Well, I have to say, this celestial session is one of my favorite parts of the show, because I just really admire the moon in all of her beautiful phases, and really appreciate the biodynamic wisdom as well. So this week, we are in the descending moon time, or planting time. The energies are going downward, and it's time to get some things in the ground. So today and tomorrow, with the moon in Gemini, an air sign, will make it a good time to plant our flowering plants. And this could mean so many things here in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Little annuals all the way up to big, beautiful gardenia bushes and the like. So good time to think about doing that. Friday, the moon will be in Cancer, a water sign, making it time to plant our leafy plants. Saturday through Monday, the moon will have a nice long stint in the constellation of Leo, which is a fire sign, making it a good time to plant our fruits. Mm. So whether you be in your garden or in your orchard, good time to get some of those fruiting plants in the ground. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Virgo, an earth sign, making it a great time to work with our root plants.
Mm-hmm. And we think about the celestial influences as directly influencing the daily growth and activity of our plants. All their physiology is affected by these influences. And as well, they are, of course, influenced by the climate, the temperature, and wind patterns, precipitation patterns. And where I'm leading us is that we're going to have a discussion right now about El Niño, which is a very interesting phenomenon I've come to understand a little bit more from my research, and looking forward to putting it into a bowl with your knowledge, Robin, mixing it up and seeing what we come up with. But what I'm talking about is often referred to as ENSO, as a shortened version of the El Niño Southern Oscillation. And this is a phenomenon where warm waters in the equatorial Pacific Ocean change weather patterns around the globe. It's related to wind speed, from what my research led me to believe, is that when the winds slow down, the surface of the ocean is basically allowed to sit more in one location, and then it warms up.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And I believe in the very long ago past history, people noticed that the fish populations would move along with these warm water currents. So the oceans we know make up most of the planet, so that what's going on with them has a very large impact on how our weather patterns come on to land where we live, where most people live, although some people do live out there on the ocean too.
Right. And even though this phenomenon is occurring in the Pacific Ocean, the largest body of water on Earth, and why it has such a pronounced effect, it has far-ranging effects that stretch across the whole world, really. However, here in the Hawaiian Islands, we are more likely, and throughout the Pacific, we are more likely to experience stronger extreme weather events coupled with drought and drying events. So more of those sort of patterns that we hear are associated with climate change, which is you may see reduced precipitation, but when it comes, it's going to come all at once. So it's more an increase in the extremes, and so there's a lot of concern across the world about damages that can be caused, whether it be from drought or from a hurricane or a cyclone hitting.
Correct. And, you know, over the past, say, 7 decades or so, as El Nino has been studied more closely, it has been occurring more frequently than it did, again, in the long ago past. So there's no particular time on the cycle. We were talking last year that El Nino may be coming around, but didn't really quite manifest until this year. And part of that were 2 cyclones that happened this winter over in the western central Pacific. One of them you remember hearing about pretty much wiped Vanuatu pretty darn good. That one was north of the equator and turning towards the equator. And at the exact same time, there was a cyclone directly below it on the other side of the equator, on the southern side. And they were both spinning towards the equator, which flushed a huge amount of hot water across the equator, which is now reaching us. If I look on the Central Pacific Hurricane Center, which is something I keep bookmarked on my computer during hurricane season and actually throughout the year, the sea surface temperatures are quite high just south of us here right now, and it is already hurricane season, and there's been a couple of, you know, big storms already generating off of Baja Peninsula, where most of our big storms get generated that head towards Hawaii. Although I believe that some of the hype around, oh, it's going to be really bad hurricane year, is maybe just a little bit of fear mongering going on there. Certainly always good to be prepared and always good to have your supplies on hand and pay attention so that we can be prepared as best we can for things like this.
And again, the prediction of a small to moderate El Nino effect was the official word out of the, was that the Hurricane Agency?
Yes.
And yet, like so many things on the planet, there are so many interlocking factors. It's the only way to know is just to see what becomes. Unfortunately, it is also these warmer sea temperatures due to El Nino are also a strong contributing effect to coral bleaching as well, which we know that we're having extreme difficulties with here in the Hawaiian waters as well as across the planet, really, but just more compounded effects giving our coral reef as well as all the life that depends on it a really difficult time right now.
It's true. It's true. So, I've already noticed it dried out quite a bit. It's very, very dry where I live. And as a gardener, I'm just suggesting to you fellow gardeners out there to get your irrigation systems tuned up, get them working well, get some extra batteries for your timers if you need to. I had a timer go out, and it only took a few days for plants to just wilt down. I wasn't watching closely enough. And it's definitely looking like a dry summer, so any rainwater collection that we can possibly do to supplement other water systems, all these kinds of things are going to be important for us this season. Mm-hmm. And as far as I read, this effect will be happening through the end of the year here, through the end of 2015. So that's about half the year.
Mm-hmm. Well, time will tell.
Indeed it will.
You're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Later in this hour, we're going to be talking about foliar feeding and tending and grooming our plants. But right now, we're going to take a special focus on one of the real workhorses of the garden and something that for sure is going to put food on your plate almost as soon as you plant it. And Robin's going to share some of her love for one of our most beloved garden friends.
Yes, you know, in my small garden, I need only plant one of these. And it's a variety that I was turned on to by the good graces of the Kauai Community Seed Bank. I knew nothing of Ethiopian kale before you brought it into our lives, Paul. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. A great plant as a starting seed saver to be able to get dependable seed off is this Ethiopian kale.
It's true. 2 years ago, I grew out 6 of them for a seed crop, and the seed I'm still now using, and it's just big, plump, beautiful seed. And with that many plants, I was taking trips to the food pantries to donate some of those greens because there was literally, I call it a food factory. It's a factory. It is just cranking out. Within 6 weeks, it's already gotten to about between 4 and 5 feet tall, multi-branching, and the leaves are absolutely delicious. They're slightly spicy and smooth and delicious. When I pick a younger leaf, I love to steam or saute it. It really reminds me of spinach. But they're really good for juicing too, especially if you like, sort of flavorful juices. With the extra flavor involved there in the Ethiopian kale, you get a lot of extra phytonutrients. It's very rich in phytonutrients.
And I'm curious about the purple color. It's got a beautiful purple in the stem. And what is that phytonutrient that makes things purple? Because I've got the lycopene for the red.
Sure. You know, I wish I knew the name. I don't. Although purple, although is very natural and common on Ethiopian kale, in other plants can signal a phosphorus deficiency.
Right.
So according to Eating on the Wild Side, a book that I read earlier this year, purples and reds have the most phytonutrients, but I'm not recalling the specific name of that one that makes that plant purple. However, there's lots of vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin K, which is very good for bone health, vitamin B complex, and lots of our elements and nutrients like copper, calcium, sodium, potassium, iron, manganese, and phosphorus. So a real powerhouse there. And
you can cut down on eating spoonfuls of soil when you incorporate this into your diet.
Exactly. It's just a beautiful plant. It grows, again, to probably 5 feet at its peak. And in the early season, before it goes into flowering and seed production, the leaves are just very large and beautiful and so delicious. It's kind of an oddball variety. It's not your typical kale plant. But boy, what a winner in the garden. And if you have ever visited the seed exchange, I'd say almost without fail, there are Ethiopian kale seeds that are given away by the seed bank every time. So if you haven't tried that variety out yet, I highly recommend coming to our next seed exchange, unless you know somebody who's got some starts, to grow that one in your garden. Although I find it a good summer plant. I find it to be the hardiest. Have you grown that one in the shorter season, Paul?
Not so much, no. Although they will just keep going, but they it'll go year round. But it certainly luxuriates in the summertime. And I guess it's been a while since I tried to grow them in the winter. But it is a plant that will naturalize in your garden, and for sure, seeds sown in the late fall will continue to sprout and grow over the wintertime, as long as there's ample sun and warmth and moisture to get those seeds germinating.
Well, sure. Having just talked about the potential of this dry summer here, the drought tolerance of the Ethiopian kale, too, is pretty phenomenal as far as kales go. So I think it makes a great summertime choice this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen one limping along from lack of moisture. They're real hardy. And in fact, it was one of the amazing discoveries of having them growing in a very wet time. So it must have been over the winter in the community garden. And there was this gorgeous plant. It had just been raining and raining and raining and raining. This plant was one of the healthiest looking plants in the garden. And then a seed had fallen inside the greenhouse where there was no irrigation and the soil was bone dry. And there was a huge Ethiopian kale plant there as well, growing at the same time. So talk about resistance to environmental variability. Pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty great plant. Thanks again for introducing it to us on the island here. It's certainly become one of my favorite kitchen garden plants.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to move right on along into our feature for today, which is grooming and tending. We're talking about how to actually take care of the plants after we've prepped our soil and got our irrigation going and done some planting, which we've been discussing earlier in the month. And now it's time to tend the garden. And in my opinion, this is the most overlooked aspects of our gardening, because it's a lot of work, a lot of output to build and prep the soil and do all that and plant. But it's the daily monitoring that tending is so important, because when we're out there doing this work, we will observe either triumphs or problems in the garden. And it is my recommendation, and I should follow it more, given that I didn't notice my irrigation was out for a few days, but spending 10 minutes a day, just committing to a 10-minute garden meditation in the morning, perhaps, if that's possible, or later in the day, whatever works for you, is really important, because your presence there, I believe, even if you touch nothing, your presence will deter some pests. You will, your presence will, your attention kind of permeates through the space. And, you know, if you don't have a huge garden, 10 minutes is actually a lot of time out there.
Sure.
So I wanted to pick a few specific plants that I think are popular among our gardeners here and give some ideas about what I think is good grooming and tending practices for those plants.
I'm glad we're talking about this, because just like the thinning, which seems counterintuitive to some people, they want to let every plant grow. And Robin, you were sharing with us a couple of shows ago about the importance of, well, hey, we can't let everyone live. We need to give some of the plants room enough to grow. There's also this thought that, you know, well, in the wild, there's nobody grooming these plants, so maybe I'm being too heavy-handed if I'm in there pulling leaves off or doing other activities. And I think people forget that these plants have been co-evolving with humans for thousands of years. We've had this ongoing relationship. And just like domestic animals that now need their nails clipped, whereas their wild counterparts obviously don't have people out there clipping their nails, so do our garden plants even require our grooming to stay in good health.
That's correct. That's correct. And one of the most common summertime plants that people like to grow is tomatoes. So I'd like to talk a little bit about grooming and tending the tomatoes, because there are some challenges for tomato plants in the tropics here. One of them is fruit flies, of course, that want to sting the fruits. And for that matter, chickens and or cardinals, who also like to sting the fruits in their own way, like by completely abolishing them into their own stomachs. And powdery mildews, different types of funguses. So when a tomato plant is growing, and of course when we can't have this conversation without the to prune or not to prune the tomatoes. I do not practice desuckering my tomato plants. I prefer to let them run wild. But if you've got the time and the energy and you really like large tomatoes, that is definitely one way to increase the size of the tomatoes you do get, is by removing suckers. And suckers are branches that grow out of leaf nodes from the main stalk of the tomato. And I prefer to use, I have a big trellis right now that's a wood trellis. However, a very handy way to keep your tomato plant sort of in check, I guess, is to use 6-foot hog fencing and cut a length of it and turn it in on itself into a cylinder of sorts. And you can either use the ends of the cut metal of the fencing itself to clip it together, or a few zip ties, and to make a 6-foot tall, maybe 2 feet across or more, cylinder that I put over top of the plant when it's first young and starting out. Because tomatoes take a lot of space up in the garden. If you decide to desucker them and prune them, they'll take up less room. But if you don't want to take that effort and you just want to get more tomatoes, even if they're smaller, these cylinders work great by making sure that as the plant's growing up, you keep tucking it inside the cylinder, not letting too many branches come out the sides. And that'll be 6 feet by the time it reaches the top of the cylinder. And guess what? That thing's just getting started. Some of these tomato varieties are 12 to 15 feet in length. So then if it gets all the way to the top and it can start to spill out over the sides of your cylinder, you get 6 more feet all the way back to the ground. That's a pretty compact way to hold 12 feet of tomato plant.
Now, what about harvesting inside that cylinder and even getting your older leaves off?
Sure, which is why I use the hog fencing with large squares so that you can easily get your hands in and out of there for ease of harvesting. Now, if you experience some problems like blossom end rot or, you know, blossom drop altogether, or tomatoes that happen to get stung or aren't going to be edible for some reason or another, part of the grooming and tending is to remove those from the plant. And if they've already dropped to the ground, you want to pick them up and take them away, because a fallen fruit could easily get stung as well. And then you're breeding fruit flies right underneath your new tomatoes. So the likelihood of them getting stung is going to be much greater in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the leaves go, so picking up dropped fruits, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And leaves, it would be very natural for most plants to lose leaves from the bottom of the plant. The older leaves eventually will want to sort of, you know, yellow up and fall off. And it's natural in the tropical environment we live in for molds of some sort or funguses to start to deteriorate those leaves. And when you have a bunch of brown or yellowing leaves at the bottom of your tomato that might be getting some mildew, it's not a long trip for that mildew to jump on to your fresh, new growing leaves or even stems. I've seen in really harsh situations, tomato stems will show the powdery mildew infection as well.
Mm-hmm.
So grooming the tomatoes is taking a, and in fact, when you do your 10 minutes a day, I recommend taking 2 buckets to the garden. One is going to be for the good stuff that you're going to bring in, and the other one is going to be for stuff that's going to go in the compost. So you're prepared. You're, when you go in there, you've got what you need. And you take the yellowing and brown leaves off the plant. If they've fallen already and they're sandwiched in between 2 stems, gently get them out of there. And what we do is it's airflow, airflow, airflow. When it comes to the tomatoes, that's what's so important. And those dying leaves in there definitely diminish the airflow a bit and can lead to problems. So much of this grooming and tending is really about pest prevention, in my mind, although it also adds to the beauty and the aesthetics of your garden as well when things look nice and clean and open. I think it's really important. So that is pretty much it about tomatoes for now, unless we want to go into some more detail. But another one that's really hot on my mind, I know a lot of people grow, are kales of all kinds. And brassicas are tricky. It's taken me some years now to really refine how I grow brassicas. Some of them, particularly cabbages and broccolis, they don't really respond that well to grooming. I don't think they like so much for their leaves to be clipped. And again, powdery mildew can be a pretty serious problem on some brassicas, particularly in wetter areas with a little more humidity going. And
so it's with that pruning, if you will, then to take some of the leaves for a meal, but you don't want to take the whole plant. It's introducing sites where disease can get in. Is that what you're observing? When you say they don't like it, are they getting sick after being pruned? Or
I think, like, well, each brassica would kind of have its own personality there. In the example of cabbages, they don't head up as nice. The heads don't get as big. Maybe it's a photosynthesis thing that they mm-hmm. need all those lower leaves. So there, it's about proper spacing from the beginning.
Yes.
So you don't have crowding and you're not going to have a lot of leaves dying off. But kales in particular, what I'd like to talk about, because I think harvesting kales is a technique that I want more people to learn about. I use a pair of small shears, scissors in my garden to do a lot of the harvesting I do, eggplants or cucumbers. I don't always like to just break those off. Sometimes they don't want to break off, or if I left my okra a little too long on the plant, you know, you need your scissors out there. But in the case of kales, say curly kale, I don't recommend the clipping, because what happens is you leave a little tiny stump of the leaf stem that's attached to the trunk. And again, in natural circumstances, that's going to start to die back after you've clipped the leaf off. And what happens is it'll start to rot. And if it's still touching the main trunk of the plant, very likely that the main trunk then can get a rot, and you'll get a rot in the main trunk, and that's going to very, very much reduce the lifespan of your kale plant. So I recommend putting your thumb in just above the leaf and doing a quick snap so you cleanly break that stem off of the main trunk of the kale. And that would be for all kales. That would be lacinato kales, the Ethiopian kale we just spoke about, even other plants like gailan that we eat the leaves from. In general, with brassicas, collards comes to mind. We want to make a clean, nice clean snap off of that main trunk, of course, gently. And if the plant's very young, you're going to want to stabilize it with your other hand and not, you know, kind of just yank on it, because you could potentially uproot it.
Now, what if it is the flowering head of a brassica, like a broccoli cauliflower or kailan, for instance?
Yes.
You cut those, or are you breaking those as well?
No, I cut those, yeah. And I cut those with a sharp pair of scissors on a diagonal. Mm-hmm. You do not want to cut those flat, because your irrigation water or potentially rainwater will fall down and sit on a flat surface, and again, rot will begin. Now, I've seen some broccoli varieties that will just plow right through that rot and just keep going. Mm-hmm. If they're really happy. I mean, brassicas in general, I say lay it down on the fertilizer from the very beginning, and you get a nice strong plant that really will withstand problems. Mm-hmm. But clipping them, and of course, I would say clip them on a flower day, because, or a fruit day, a day when the moon is in a dry sign as opposed to the wet signs of water and earth, because you'll get a cleaner heel as well, if that's possible. I mean, if it's ready today and it's, you know, you have to make
it.
It's time to eat. But taking care of brassicas can really help you keep long-term kales in your garden if you keep them fed and you keep them weeded underneath. And you'll have listened to our show about weeding and cultivating last week to have those tips. But keeping them fed, you can easily harvest off of a kale for a year, I'd say, minimum. And if you think about some of the farmers growing them, their kales are workhorses, and they put out a lot of leaves. When we pluck leaves like that, we get long-term food out of our gardens. So, clipping. Lettuces. Lettuces, although there's varieties that will do very well in the dry, hot summer months, it's not really their favorite time of year. And often we either want to shade them or over-irrigate them, even perhaps, you know, a little too much water just to keep them happy. And I found, in my garden at least, that thrips really loves it when that happens. The plant's a little stressed out from the heat, and now it's got a very wet environment. Thrips can be, the way I diagnose it, is it's got a silvery sheen kind of on the backs of the leaves. And again, thrips, I mean, you just, you know, blink and you've got a huge population. They're really fast moving. And I say keep those lettuce plants clean. If you're not harvesting whole heads of lettuce in your garden and you're just clipping leaves, again, you've got your two buckets. You've got the one you can take all the leaves that show signs of that, and maybe you'll, in your observations, will decide, I think it's time to pick that whole lettuce. And you can then clip the lettuce and bring it into your kitchen.
But you do leave the root system in place and that piece of stem, even if it might rot in the field next to your other growing plants.
Yes, I generally leave those because in organic systems, you know, the root systems can be bigger, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of organic material that you're then allowing to stay in the garden. Cucumbers, another very fun summer plant, and a lot like tomatoes, fruit flies, powdery mildew, pretty much their worst enemies. So we want to be out there clipping any old and yellowing leaves that look like they might have some kind of a mildew. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing this, you will be observing the stems of the plant. And that, to me, is the most important part with the cucumbers, because we grow varieties that are fairly fruit fly resistant, but none yet that I've met are resistant to the pickle worm. and the pickle worm. We're going to do a lot more on pest and disease management next month, but it does drill into the stems, and I'll leave it at that. And if you're out there grooming your plants, you will see the drills, and then you will know that you've got to treat it. And we'll talk more about treatment options for that when we get into that particular topic.
Mm-hmm. And then as well, training your plants, too, when you have a small cucumber vine getting started and you're thinking about the trellis, sometimes it seems like they want to run away from what you had intended for them to climb on.
Why do they do that? And, you know, I've noticed that if their little tendrils wrap around something else and you just kind of grab it and move the vine and you break their little tendrils, they actually don't like that very much.
Mm.
It does not make them happy. So yes, part of our grooming and tending with the vining plants, including tomatoes, is to get some either ripped strips of t-shirt or whatever it is and actually gently tie the stems up to our trellises so that they can move in the right direction. Training vines is definitely part of the grooming and tending process that we mm-hmm. must go through if we want to have really abundant, healthy gardens.
And so when you're really loving a cucumber, do you unwind the tendrils?
I do.
Lovingly.
I do, yes. Actually. It's
and
kind of fun.
Boy, you got to be out there every day if you're going to keep up with that job.
With that job. But once you get them firmly in their place on whatever it is they're growing, they tend to stay with that. But at first, they're just really just searching. Mm-hmm. And, okay, clipping. Basil's part of tending of our herb plants. And in basils in particular, I'll talk about first, is once the plant starts flowering, the leaf production is going to get smaller and smaller, both in size and quantity. So many plants that are annuals here in the subtropics kind of extend themselves. They can be, their lifetime can be extended by the gardener, by stopping it from making seeds, basically. And we all know that flowers come before fruits and then seeds, of course. So if we clip off the basil flowers, we're going to have bigger leaves for a longer period of time. And other herbs such as thyme, you know, your long-term herbs, we were just discussing that those like to be grazed in nature. If we go back to, you know, their natural settings, they've been grazed and munched on by roving animals. And so we need to be those grazers in our own gardens and find reasons to use your herbs. I mean, mint is a perfect example. If let to grow tall, eventually it'll start to languish. It's when it gets cut down hard back to those ground runners, it'll send up a whole new flush mm-hmm. of fresh growth. And so many of the other herbs that we would make teas out of or use in our sauces and spice blends.
And the tenderness of the new growth, too, is a really important quality with some of the herbs as well, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, things will get leathery if they're left out there, you know, day after day, week after week in the blazing sun. Of course, the leaves are going to harden down into bearing that kind of heavy sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
So, flowers, too. I mean, in our summer gardens, we like to grow marigolds and zinnias. And, you know, one of the variety names of zinnias is cut and come again. Well, that indicates that deadheading your flowers or even live-heading them, cutting off some nice blossoms while they're in full bloom, will encourage more flowering.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you don't want to cut your flowers and you like to leave them out there in the garden, and maybe you even want to collect a little bit of seed off of some of them, and that's all well and good to tag or label the ones you want to leave for seed. But in general, if we keep those dying or dead flowers off, we're going to get more of a profusion of blooms as the year goes along. And if you think about the structure and the form of the plant, often the flower's at the peak. So when we cut it, we then get two shoots mm-hmm. coming. Mm-hmm. So you're actually making your plant bushier and fuller and increasing how much either vegetation or herbs or flowers you'll get down the road. So this is a really important part of tending is to get the dead things out of there, you know. Dead leaves, if you've harvested, I know I already left kale, but if you've harvesting your kale and you see some yellowing ones that you wouldn't want to eat, they're the ones that go in your other bucket, the bucket that goes to feed the compost, because kales don't like dead kale leaves hanging around the bottom of the plant. Bugs will come to there, and then they're just one hop away from your fresh growing leaf.
Mm-hmm. We could also decide to remove flowers or young fruits off of plants that haven't really achieved a considerable size yet. Right now I'm fussing over some long beans that I brought back from Thailand. I'm really wanting to make sure that I get some good seed production later on in the season. And so while the plants are still small, I'm removing
the blossoms, or the
very young fruits long before you'd even have a modest meal out of it, but just wanting to encourage that plant to stay in vegetative growth for a longer period of time before it starts putting its energy toward fruit production.
Sure, and along those lines, peppers fall into that same category. This time of year, peppers want to kind of start flowering right away, so you can have a 6-inch plant with 6 flowers on it. I think it's important part of tending and grooming to pick those little flowers off, let the plant get a little bigger before it starts setting fruit. You're really just increasing the amount of fruit that you'll get in the long term, and I think making a sturdier plant.
Yes. This is In the Garden on the Farm. We're talking about tending, grooming, training, and in all ways looking after our plants during their establishment period into production so that we can encourage their good health and get better yields out of them as well.
That's right. Another plant I can think of that's a great summertime plant is okra. And okra, again, as an annual, if you leave those pods on the plant a little too long and they start hardening off some seeds, the plant's really going to slow down. Mm-hmm. It's when you clip off or break off when they're young enough, the young okras, and when they're perfect for eating, is you'll get much more production over the course of the year. Mm-hmm. And we talked with, I think it was Joseph Dunsmore last year, a little bit about okra, and he even recommended after your first flush of fruiting on the very top of the plant to top it and allow some side branches to come out and make a shorter plant much easier to harvest and lots more. You kind of make that sea of green kind of thing going on when you top the plant and you encourage it to get wider. So you want to consider these kinds of things, how realistic that is for you when you're planting, how much space you want to give them, knowing how you might decide to train them. And
another example, Roselle, a plant that is closely related to okra, and I see going to flower bud at a very young age, and certainly thinking of when I'm spending my 10 minutes in the garden later today of pulling those flower buds off and telling the plant, not yet. Do some more growth, young one. We want to see you produce heavily. And I know there's different varieties of Roselle that we grow, Robin. The one that you have introduced to us and we go back to has more of a lower habit to begin with. But I can imagine the value of, if we have one of those tall Roselles, of also topping it like the okra, to get a bushier habit and altogether easier plant to work with.
Sure. And, you know, a little tip there that I learned from a tree trimmer friend is that when we are topping a plant like this and we're cutting at an angle always, whichever the upper side of your angle is the side that the plant will rebud from. So if it's against a wall or against a fence and you want to guide which way your new bud will emerge from, you want to leave the high point of the cut in that direction right above that node.
Opposite the obstruction.
Exactly.
If there were to be one, like another plant or a wall or such.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Exactly.
Thanks for that
tip. It will always bud on the upper side of your cut, whichever one it is. So that goes for tea plants, you know, regular Hawaiian tea, whichever angle you cut at, they can bud from almost anywhere along the stem, right?
Right.
So you'll get your new bud out of the side that comes from the higher side of the cut.
Yeah, tremendous.
Yeah, nice way to train things. Well, really what we're trying to say is the best food for the garden is the shadow of the gardener, and that's you. So good luck, and be out there. It's so fun to be out and observe. If we make our gardens beautiful, it's easier to keep them beautiful if we just give a little bit of routine work every day versus letting it go and go and then having to go in and do a big swoop.
Yep. Well, the more we love our gardens, the more rewarding it is to spend that 10, 20, or 30 minutes in the garden. I know sometimes when I've neglected the garden, it's with a bit of shame that I only want to spend so long because there are so many plants that are saying, wait, what about me? I need something. So sometimes it's just pairing up that 10 minutes with a good solid couple few hours every now and again, so that the garden is a place that is inviting us in because it's doing so well, rather than screaming for our attention because it is not doing so well.
Yes, not to be misunderstood, we definitely need to give our gardens more than 10 minutes a day. There are going to be days when you're putting in a whole day or half day of some real hard work, you know, redoing things, renovating, as I call it. Sometimes it's just time, you know.
Truly.
Well, we hope you have an abundant summer, and now we shall get into the second feature for the day, which is foliar feeding, another way to tend our plants, really, in my opinion.
And while soil building, which our feature is Secrets of the Soil Builders, produces strong, healthy plants when we really think about every component that should go in there, sometimes, even when we do that, there is still a value in feeding the plants from above in addition to below. Especially, I've heard that if we're having soil problems that's causing deficiencies, a way to sidestep that problem is to do foliar feeding. And it's also a very efficient way to use some nutrients that are maybe hard won, whether they're expensive or take a lot of energy to make, like a top quality compost tea. You're going to get a lot of value out of doing a foliar feed of it, and so this is a way to sort of mainline these nutrients and these values, micronutrients as well as microorganisms that can help support healthy plant growth. And some of our top producers depend heavily upon foliar feeding if you're looking at the commercial realm. So Robin, being a good gardener, is out there on a monthly basis or sometimes more to address particular things that she's seeing, or just gets in the habit of doing the right thing. So Robin, again, grateful for your gardening experience to give us some of the depth of the value of foliar feeding.
Sure. Well, just to step a little bit into some physiology first, when we foliar feed, what are we doing? We're feeding the plant directly, and the plant is going to be most likely to take up nutrients that we are choosing to spray onto their themselves on the undersides of their leaves. On the undersides of their leaves are little ports. I think of them as little breathing ports called stomata is the technical term. And stomata tend to be open during the early morning hours through the night and at dusk. So they kind of open up at dusk. They tend to stay open through the night and close up sometime in the morning when the sun starts to get hot. And that the reason they close up is to keep the leaves from drying out very quickly. They're conserving water during that middle part of the day. So we want to be foliar feeding either at dusk or sometime in the night. If you grow wild hair, it's full moon. That's my favorite time to do it. Pretty bright out there. Pretty fun. It does feel pretty luscious to be feeding your plants under the full moon like that. And the local knowledge is that on a full moon, the root hairs of the plants are rising like the tide. And so the nutrition that will be dripping off of the leaves as you foliar feed will be dripping right down onto those beautiful little root feeder root hairs and be nourishing the plant from under as well as above. So stomata also love the sound of bird song, it turns out. And there's just a fantastic website. I know I've talked about it here on the show before, Sonic Bloom. and Dan Carlson is his name, and he discovered that the healthy forests had, which had lots of bird populations, had healthier plants. So it is indeed the sounds of the bird songs that help the stomatas, in fact, even increases the amount of stomata on the plant and strengthens each individual one. And so if you already are living in a pretty healthy environment, you've got the birds there with you when you're foliar feeding, all the better. Or there's a CD out there that you can buy, and it will mimic the sound of a healthy forest and the birds. And if you foliar feed while literally playing these sounds to your plants, you will get more out of your foliar feed simply because more stomata will take in more.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
Oh,
his goal was to end world hunger, and this is how he decided to approach it.
Wow.
And I think it's fantastic.
That's so cool, because I've thought about, while I knew that morning and evening were the right times, I was thinking, what's the precise time and how does it depend on the time of year? And now just to know, just do it when the birds sing is such a beautiful timing.
Exactly.
You don't need to calculate it. You just need to be there.
You
and
just
have your ears open.
Exactly.
I love it.
Exactly. So there's so many different formulas that we'd want to use for one reason or another. Just a really simple one that I find is really beneficial to my plants is Maxi Crop or some kind of seaweed extract. Find it to be fantastic for those trace nutrients in the plants. They really love it. That standing alone is a very, very good foliar spray. And compost tea, of course, high quality compost tea. We won't go into details about how to come by that. I know some of the local garden shops are actually offering it brewed up fresh, but it is something you want to use fresh. So if you're making it yourself at home with a small aerator, like an aquarium aerator, you want to be aerating it and using it at the same time. You don't want the air to stop, because within just a few hours of no air, the explosion of population that's happening inside of there will start to fall.
Right.
I also really like some of the Korean natural farming preparations for foliar feeding. In fact, that's how a lot of them are applied. And we're going to talk about Ray's class that's coming up. It's a great place to learn about how to make some of these formulas, but LAB, lactic acid bacteria, very good. It's also like pest control, but also for the green growth, the growth phase of the plant is definitely a booster. Very good, very easy to come by. And brown rice vinegar, I don't want to go in too much to the natural farming ones because I could do a whole nother hour just talking about them, but they are nice to be applied to the plant in high dilutions. And then, okay, how do we actually apply it to the plant? What are our tools for foliar feeding? Well, there's a few options. If you have a very small space, just a simple...
You are listening to Kauai Community Radio, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Moloa'a, and K284AL Hale'iva. We have about another 5 to 7 minutes left of the garden show, so I'm going to keep...